You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The historic Strathcona district was the most cosmopolitan quarter of Vancouver for more than 100 years. It was home to Chinatown, Japantown, the loggers Skid Row, and Little Italy. Around 1900, it became the refuge of the city's working and immigrant classes when better-off Vancouverites migrated westward. Between 1977 and 1978, Strathcona writers Daphne Marlett and Carol Itter knocked on doors in the neighborhood to gather some of the stories of the early days. The 50 oral histories they recorded became the book Opening Doors in Vancouver's East End, Strathcona. Long out of print, it's been republished to celebrate Vancouver's 125th anniversary. And to mark the occasion, we're going to play a radio documentary about the book given to us by Carol Itter. The documentary was produced in Co-op Radio Studios in 1980 by Ingrid Klassen and Howard Broomfield. You'll hear the voices of Carol Itter and Daphne Marlett. And some of the pioneers you'll hear in the documentary are Mrs. Violet Benedetti, Austin Phillips, a former resident of Hogan's Alley, and Mrs. Benny, of Benny's Grocery Store on Union Street. The documentary starts with traffic noise on the street, but soon moves into the rich, warm sound of our old studios on Carroll Street.
I'm standing on a street called Atlantic Street. It's about two blocks long in Vancouver, and not very many people know where it is. The background noise you hear is the Canadian National and Great Northern diesels humming away. We're looking south at the Canadian National rail yards. Atlantic Street used to be called Grove Crescent, and it's why it was called Grove Crescent is that it was a beautiful grove of trees that sits high on a hill overlooking what was once False Creek. I'll backtrack a little bit. When you are going east across the New Georgia Viaduct in Vancouver, you can find Atlantic Street by, instead of roaring along Pryor Street, taking your first turn to your right and driving up on this little known street called Atlantic Street. And from here you have quite a fantastic view of the back end of the rail yards in Vancouver, and also a view of Grandview and going up Main Street south.
You have the old shoreline of False Creek, which used to run all the way up to Clark Drive as the northern boundary. That's Atlantic, southern boundary. That's Grove, now Atlantic. And then on the northern boundary, you have the harbor, the shoreline of the harbor. And on the eastern boundary, you have a ravine that used to run from the edge of False Creek, the shore of False Creek, all the way over to Burrard Inlet, roughly between Campbell and Raymuir. And the viaduct on Hastings Street, which they've been busily rebuilding over the last 6 months, used to span, or does span, what used to be that ravine. And there was a similar one on Pryor Street, which is, it's all been filled in with land, so you don't notice it. And then just where we're sitting, we are actually sitting in this building on the western boundary, because there used to be very low-lying swamp, another canoe crossing at high tide, just between Carroll and Columbia. So we took Columbia as our western boundary.
The area was bush.
Yeah, bush and swamp.
So what we're actually talking about is the birth of Vancouver.
Yeah, that's right. First the mill, then the saloon, then the railroad.
I'm wondering today, if you were taking someone on a tour of the neighborhood, what each of you might point out about Strathcona in the past.
Well, I think, Carol, you should speak to that, because you and Harold just did a little tour of the neighborhood.
Yes, this morning we walked the circumference and talked mostly about the former geography and how the area has changed.
Grove Crescent was a beautiful grove of trees. From the reading I did in the archives, it seems that before they decided to put Stanley Park as our park, designated park area in Vancouver, they also considered this part of Vancouver to be saved as park. Right now it's bordered on the on the north side of the street by narrow wood frame homes, and on the south side again is this view of the rail yards. Well, I love rail yards, but what was here before is what really interests me. Falls Creek used to flood right back through this area. It used to cross Main Street going east and flood maybe a half mile, a full mile at high tide going east into Vancouver. There was very little outflow, that is fresh water flowing into this part of Falls Creek. The main one was China Creek, which is far to our southeast from here, and that flew out of Trout Lake in Burnaby.
Mrs. Benny, tell Howard how Falls Creek was different then and how you used to use it.
It was a little ocean. That's what I call it. Water from way down past Cambie, right down to the end of Campbell Avenue. All water. And there was a drawbridge there that used to open. They don't have it now. You know where Terminal Avenue is?
Yeah.
That was a big bridge there. And it used to open up for the boats to go through. So my sister was 18, 19 at the time, and they had rowboats to go across, but you took your own chances. So my mother would say to me, go with your sister. Go in the rowboat. She had a boyfriend with her. What could I do in a rowboat? It's a beautiful moonlight night, and here the moon is shining on the water, and I'm playing with the water. But when I got home, my mother said, well, what happened? I said, I don't know. I was playing with the water. I wouldn't tell if I didn't know.
We're walking along train tracks now, walking north in Vancouver. The tracks are a connecting line between the CN station and the CPR lines, which are on Vancouver's harbour side. The traffic noise in the background is Prior Street. You take your life in your hands trying to get across Prior Street. The train tracks that we're following are on a very low-lying piece of ground in Vancouver. And Daphne and I, when we were trying to decide what would be our borders of the neighborhood, since there were no definite borders then, chose that this low-lying ground is our eastern border.
I'd like to know very graphically what you did when you approached the door.
Gulped.
Knock on it.
We often made it through introductions through other people.
Sometimes we wrote letters to people introducing ourselves before we approached them.
Did you use any kind of lead questions specifically, like who were your neighbors?
No. No, we didn't use that question at all.
We didn't use that question, although we heard a lot about neighbors. But we did, we generally began chronologically. We generally began with, were you born here? And if not, where did your parents come from? Or where did you come from? You know, it began with the story of getting here.
So how do you take people back into, how do you take people back to that? Through that time tunnel, so that you capture what that was when it was happening.
Some people are willing to go back to the feeling of it, you know, and other people are not. They would rather give you facts and surface detail. There are people who could go back and sort of recreate the actual shape of an experience, of what that experience felt like to them, and there are other people who can't or don't want to do that. And it's a matter of finding what each person wants to do, is willing to do. And that's just done through asking questions, I think. We had to learn to stop asking questions, actually.
You can often break a story apart by asking too many questions in the middle of it. These people, many that we listened to, were natural storytellers and would talk easily about their their past experiences. And if you suddenly break and say, well, what date did that happen? Yeah. The date was the farthest thing from their mind. They're into a really incredible story. So we had to learn not to interrupt, not to ask too many questions, to let people take the lead.
What did Vancouver, downtown Vancouver, seem like to you when you got here from...
To tell you the truth about it, I was frightened. I don't know why I was frightened. I don't like to talk about it because Vancouver was a rough... That, when I came to the coast here, it was rugged, really rugged. It was a sort of a red light district in there on Main and Hastings. And you walk down the street and you see the ladies with their little doodads on, little dresses on, like they were, and you'd pass the windows and they'd be knocking on the windows. It was awful.
How many body houses and bootleggers did you see during these 2 years?
Did we see doors on which we knocked, you mean?
Yes.
I don't think the neighborhood's too active in that direction anymore. One person told us, and I think it's in the book, that there were about 70 body houses in the neighborhood, which is a lot.
You can still see the tile entranceways on Alexander Street, and sometimes the names of the women who ran the places.
Union Street was so full of body houses that the people on the east of which avenue, Victoria, or was it Campbell, who lived on Union Street, it was called Union all the way along there, petitioned to the city to have their street, their name changed. So it's now called Adanac Street. And the house I live in on Union Street was, we were told, was one of the last body houses in the neighborhood right up until the 50s.
Carol!
So I took my amber light out of my porch and replaced it with a yellow one.
Your amber light, your red light.
Yeah. Amber.
It's a sore point in a way, because the neighborhood had a reputation of being, I've even heard it referred to as Vancouver's Square Mile of Sin. Within the neighborhood, it didn't feel that way. And all of this has to be put in the perspective of Vancouver being, until the 60s, essentially a very provincial town based on Anglo-Saxon Protestant virtues.
How do you transcribe that sound, and someone, Carol, talks about it in the book, how you do that transcription, the oral to the page, you know, how you capture, first of all, the sound it is, and then also you talked about someone notating the silences. This is the final package here.
I don't think the book is the final package. I think the original package are the original tapes that are, and there's about 100 hours of them stored in the archives. And the book is a manifestation of it that will get to a great many people. So the sound tapes are still the large part of the large package.
Well, but the thing that used to happen, I came out here in 35, and that's about the first place I wanted to. I didn't know anybody in town, just walked right down as though I'd been to town before and ended up in Hogan's Alley. The first guy was, I just got off of a freight train and somewhere out here by the ocean and started walking. Knew nobody in town, so I didn't think I did.
Had you heard about it beforehand?
What?
Had you heard about Hogan's Alley before?
No,
you
never heard about it before. I just walked there as though I've been there all my life. Well, the first guy I meet, you could get your meals, you know, you could get meals from this way. Hamburger and a cupcake and maybe a piece of pie, 15 cents, a cup of coffee. Pork chop, 25 cents. And what you get today, it costs you $2, you could get for 25 cents in those days. And they had a, like, going through the alleyway, see this, see that. Everybody, some people probably laying on wagon wheels, had a bunch of old broken wagons out on this old-time lot. The grass maybe grew up around it about a foot high, 2 feet high, something like that.
Hey, Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Kansas City.
4,000 pages of transcript, 4,000 to 5,000 pages of transcript. It started off with them asking for a 700-word article, and when we started opening a few doors, we found we'd opened a honeypot or bee's hive, whichever way you want to look at it, and that there was a very large story to be told. There are still so many more stories, and the book having been printed, we're still hearing stories. There's another 5 books could be done of people's stories.
That's how Mr. Benny bought this store, because when he was working in the ditch, he was a sick man when he came from it, the sick all his life. He stopped to smoke a cigarette, and the foreman came along and said, "Look, Benny, you want to smoke a cigarette, you smoke it on your time," and he told him in Italian where to go. So he quit. He quit. I wouldn't dare say it now because it's not nice, but they know what it means anyway. So he went down to old Peeney's, and he was a gambler. And he won a lot of money, and he bought the store because he told the boss, "Italian salute for you."
So he won the store in a gambling game?
Yes.
When was it that Italian people here started being like lawyers and doctors and things like that?
Let me see now, Angelo, see, when he graduated from high school, he learned from the others, you know. He never went to university.
He was one of the first, and there's been lots more since.
He didn't go to university. All the other lawyers used to come to him to find out. That's true.
Hmm.
He just, he was lucky. You try and do that today, you can't do
no.
it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it was for him at that time.
You learned from working with another group?
That's what he did. But he was good, really. A good family.
Uh-huh.
Mother, father, all of them.
As we got further in depth in the project, we possibly knew gaps that we were looking for, let's say activities during World War II that we didn't know too much about. So we were looking specifically for people who knew something in that, or people who knew something about the jungles during the Depression. We were looking specifically once we knew what to look for. But at first we were asking, well, fairly generalized questions, and people just start talking, you know. The people we saw were mostly between 70, 80, 90 years old, and so many of them are storytellers and have an incredible story to tell. So they had enormous events happen in their own lifetime, and how their own personal lives were shaped by these events. These are people who are immigrating or born here of immigrant parents, so on top of these other things, they had language, they had assimilation, they had a lot to do.
Plus living with very little money and learning how to make do. There was a knowledge of how to use the actual landscape in the way that the cows were all allowed to graze down on the False Creek Flats, so that all that fallow land was mm-hmm. immediately put to use. And people knew how to gather mushrooms and pickle them, preserve them. They all had fantastic vegetable gardens.
So they all that you're talking about now are Italian people primarily?
Well, the Italians were the ones who got into the cows and the milking and the cheese making and so on. But almost everybody had a garden. The Italians were known for having roses as well as lettuce. You know, there were little differences like that.
Uh-huh.
But people knew how to grow their own food and how to feed themselves when there wasn't much money to buy groceries at the store.
Everyone kept chickens and ducks in their backyard as well as their vegetable garden.
Yeah.
And then you'd imagine a whole huge pile of cordwood as well, because all the houses were heated by wood. So you have a very full backyard and an active backyard.
Your own smokehouse and mm-hmm. everything.
That's right.
Not everyone
scavenged
did,
logs.
It sounds like technology that all the races wouldn't have.
If they came from a rural area in their own country, they had a lot of survival methods that we as urban people just never know.
What did adjustment mean? I mean, like, what showed that you were adjusting to the new country instead of removing yourself or, you know, going into a really alienated kind of state?
Well, learning the language would be a major step. Because if you didn't know the language, you couldn't even get on a bus and tell the bus driver where you wanted him to get off, where you wanted to get off, where you wanted to make sure he stopped.
Uh-huh.
I remember a story being told to us of somebody's father or grandfather who finally had got a job He had money in his pocket, and that was really important. That was a measure of one's stability, was having money and having a job. And he walked into a restaurant with the money in his pocket, and he sat down and he was going to order himself a fantastic dinner, and then he realized he couldn't order anything because he couldn't speak the language. And all he could do was point to his neighbor's plate and point to himself.
Yeah.
Possibly a lot of the banding together, grouping together that was so strong in the neighborhood was also because there was a tremendous amount of prejudice. The English were opening up Vancouver, and there just weren't the openings for other immigrant, other ethnic groups. And as long as they were insular within the neighborhood, maybe they didn't know this pressure, but as soon as they tried to step out and get a job, if you had a Jewish name, if you were Oriental, you know, if you talked with an Italian accent, you didn't get that job. You know, and they felt it very strongly.
Yeah.
So they stayed together in close family units and very tight. And the structures within were, you know, strong, healthy ones.
When they came, they had nothing. She didn't have a chair, a table, nothing. The lady next door, she had a garden. She'd give them beans, tomatoes, all kinds of vegetables, and they lived on that. And when she died, I would say Mrs. Barrett, she never forgot the kindness of that Italian woman did her. She'd come down to the Sacred Heart Church to attend the Mass, because she'd come over here after. And I said to her, so you think because my son's a premier, I'm going to get a bigger check? I congratulated her, you know, because I thought it was really wonderful. Because they were funny people. They spoke from the heart. Come on.
Yeah.
The grandmother was going up and down the street, which is the Dave Barrett today. She's going up and down the street. Hey, my Rosie. The mother's name was Rosie. My Rosie, baby boy, baby boy. This is Dave Barrett today. But they were poor. They were really poor. Make you cry, Kel. But we always, whatever we had, we gave them. My mother was like that, too. But you know, being Jewish, Carol, she stuck by us. When I had Raymond, she come to the hospital to see me. She brought me a beautiful plant. It's still in, what's her name, Lorraine? The rose tree is still there.
What was it that brought you into the neighborhood? Like, neither of you are of the races that traditionally...
With the same original reasons, low rent.
And interest, you know? I had lived... I've lived in a number of different areas of Vancouver, and in all of them, except for perhaps the first block I lived on, in North Van, soon after I came to the city, that felt like a neighborhood, and blocks that I've lived on in Kits have felt like a neighborhood. But aside from that, this is the only other area of the city I've lived in that I felt I've been living in a neighborhood where people have concern for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And they communicate with each other. I communicate with my neighbor across the alley, even though she and I can hardly say a word of the same language to each other. But we still communicate with each other, and we know that each other is there. We know a lot about each other's habits and routines. And I hope she knows that if she ever needs help, she could certainly get it from me.
I was astounded when I moved into the neighborhood. I knew really nothing about the area. And within 3 months, I'd met all my closest neighbors. They'd greeted me on the street and said, hello, you're new to the neighborhood. I live over there. And I was just astounded. I just suddenly felt secure. And people since then have subsequently told me that about the neighborhood. They've moved into it for a while and said, people here are wonderful. They say hello to each other on the street. And that makes a place somewhat unique. Also, when you look down the street, there's always people. You see people on the sidewalks all the time. There's not that many areas of Vancouver, suburbs or residential areas, where you do see so many people on the street at any time.
Especially in the summertime. Everybody comes out, put their chairs on the sidewalk, sit and talk. The little kids stay up till the night comes in the park, playing on the swings.
Mrs. Benny, when you were a young girl in the neighborhood, say in 1910, 1916, were there many English in the neighborhood then? Do you remember them?
Yes, at that time, sure. All around here, Pryor, Atlantic, Union, Georgia, and Kiefer. All those that I knew were English.
What were they like? Did they live differently than the Italians?
Sure they did.
How differently? What?
Well, they didn't eat the kind of food we ate in the first place.
Uh-huh.
And they liked to have a good time laughing and singing and drinking a lot.
Yeah.
Especially the Scotch people. They were happy people, really. Really happy. And then when the foreigners began to come in, they didn't like it, so they moved out. Then after they moved out came the Jewish people. Then came the Swedes, the Russians, Slavs, and the Italians were last.
That neighborhood was originally built by the people who thought of themselves as the true British Columbian pioneers. They were here before the railroad.
Uh-huh.
And they naturally developed well-to-do houses, I mean, by those standards. Those big old wooden houses were genteel houses, and that was their neighborhood. But then when the CPR came in, they built over in the West End, where the Hudson's Bay is, that corner right there, Georgia and Granville, that became the sort of nexus for the CPR holdings. And that's how come you now have City Hall up there instead of where it used to be, which was right on Main Street, right on Main and Hastings. You see, you had this pull in two directions,
uh-huh.
But it was the west side of town that won out. And so then these houses were empty, and the people who moved into them were the immigrants who came into the neighborhood. And because this was close to the big industries, you know, this was close to the mill, this was close to the railroad, this was close to Rogers Sugar Refinery. You have people immediately moving in so that they're close to their work.
Some groups we just didn't have any luck with at all, or very little luck. The early English, we approached many, many of them, and a lot of them just didn't want to be taped.
And they had stories, and they would invite us for tea and tell us wonderful stories, and then say, gee, I don't think I could face a tape recorder.
Was that what it was?
Yes, this technology, they weren't familiar with. People asked us why we didn't use video, and it would have been marvelous to have done it in video as well, but that would have been just so cumbersome. Most of these people had never heard themselves on tape before, so just that much technology was ample.
Because the neighborhood is the kind of neighborhood it is, there were sometimes things that could not be said for a tape that was to be stored in the government archives.
You've been listening to a documentary produced at Co-op Radio in 1980. The hosts were Howard Broomfield and Ingrid Klassen. The guests, Carol Itter and Daphne Marlett, with clips of oral histories they recorded in the Strathcona neighborhood of Vancouver. We'd like to thank Ingrid Klassen for permission to broadcast the documentary and Carol Itter for tracking it down in her archives and being generous enough to allow us to make a copy. The book, Opening Doors in Vancouver's East End, Strathcona, is being republished by Harbor Publishing to mark Vancouver's 125th anniversary. There are several events associated with the book's revival. There's a book signing on June 1st at Strathcona Community Center. On June 5th, there's going to be a heritage tour of Strathcona and a book signing at Benny's on Union Street. The book launch will take place at People's Co-op Books on Commercial Drive in early June, so you can watch out for that. And in keeping with the book's roots in the neighborhood, you'll be able to pick up a copy at several of the local corner stores, the Wildest Snail, Union Market, and Benny's, as well as at local bookstores.